Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey. Thank you. And we really think about Johnny Cash's song tonight as he travels around the country in that truck, because tonight we're going to talk about people who occasionally travel around the country, and some of them this very moment are moving from colder venues to ones that are more warm. And our topic tonight is going to be about the homeless. It's always been a subject of interest to me. One of my friends is writing a doctoral dissertation about that subject, and he was a police officer that studied this subject and then went on to graduate school and doctoral education, and he's going to be writing a dissertation about that. But some of these folks, they're really sad cases, and they live with all kinds of diseases and other kinds of maladies, and they're on the street and they have nowhere to go. Of course, some of them do choose to stay there, but anyway, we think it'll be good to listen to that topic, especially tonight. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. If you looked around on the Blog Talk Radio Network homepage, you'll see there are thousands and thousands of shows, and when they advertise on that show or on that page that you can have your own show in literally minutes or seconds, they're not kidding. You can be broadcasting about that fast. So, I mean, people can do conference calling on there, actually. I suppose a lot actually do that. Anyway, so let's take a look at homeless here later on tonight, and we'll see what they have to say. Emily and Mike, thank you very much for joining us. You're always a big help to us. And tonight, Mike's going to help us with one of our jokes, actually. The purpose of this show is to discuss various kinds of news, issues, events, and developments in this difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Tonight's topic won't be so humorous, although some of the homeless people sometimes do confront you with things that are indeed humorous. The show is dedicated to these energetic and tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and even around the rest of the world. You know, we can't forget the corrections people. I mean, our prisons are full, literally all over the United States, except for that one prison. Mike, would you remind me to talk about the one in Colorado? Okay, that's one of the biggest goofs in criminal justice funding and planning that I've ever heard. But anyway, we try to look inside criminal justice and take a close-up look at its professionals at work. You're, like I said, Alan Levy's the founder of this place. I've said it before, CEO of Blog Talk Radio. And if you want to get yourself a show, just sign up. Any person in the interest group, no matter what you're talking about, and they've got some strange ones on there. Of course, they probably say ours is strange, right, Mike? But anyway, you can have your own show and broadcast and streaming audio all over the world, and it's absolutely free. It doesn't cost you anything. You can upgrade to premium and get a few extra things, but that's not really necessary. These shows are archived immediately, by the way, on podcastdirectory.com, and so you can come back like the next week, and they keep them on the show site also for a while if you have something that you want to listen to a second time. Never the case with our show, but anyway, we told you what our topic is about tonight. We're going to use Alex Smith's radio show content where he talks about homeless in four different cities, and he studied up on it. Again, it's a very interesting subject, and if you haven't met some of these folks out on the street, a lot of people have sort of driven by them, but they've never spoken with them. Some of them have dilemmas beyond belief and maladies, and some of them, quite frankly, just kind of like being homeless. They like being out on the street, and that's an interesting motivation to inspect also. If you want to call in to our little news segment, you can call in at 347-996-5983, and we can try to chat about some of these news items. We got a blonde joke for tonight, but we're going to let Mike do it. Mike, what are you looking for? Oh, you must have it, right? I hope. You do have the blonde joke? Okay, let's see. Let's see what that one is. You look like you're still looking. Where is it? Okay, I get it. Mike has it. It's in a file, so he's working hard to find it, and he did it. Mike?
This beautiful blonde walks into the executive director's office at NASA. She states she wants to be the first person to fly to the sun. The executive director laughs at her and says, "You don't understand. The sun is so hot that you would burn up before your ship got halfway there." She goes, "Duh, I was going to go at night."
Okay, I think I've heard that one before, Mike, but I like it. That's one of the better blonde jokes for sure. Let's do the Iowa Coalition's very important announcement about guns. We'll be talking about guns here a little bit later, but the Iowa Coalition Against Firearms would like all the criminals to turn in their guns, and here's their message.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. And I wonder, since we've been doing the radio show, how many people followed the coalition's direction, and the criminals have gone down and turned in their guns and made safer streets for all of us. I could probably count none. Oh, maybe one. Who knows? We always do a green tip, and this one tonight is pretty straightforward. I think some people might actually do this. I know back in the Ice Age when I was in the Marines, we actually did this. We didn't have vacuum cleaners, but if you look at the little book, Esma Floyd's 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet, the tip number 26 is to sweep it away, and it says, try using a broom or a dustpan and a brush as a low-energy, environmentally friendly alternative to vacuuming floors and carpets. Some vacuum cleaners come with reusable dust bags, which you empty and reuse, but even better are those that work without bags. But you could just skip that whole thing and just kind of sweep stuff up, and you wouldn't have to run any electricity. And that would work just about as well. I imagine most of the people in the world that live in homes don't even have a vacuum cleaner, right? So they clean them up some way. So that's our green tip for tonight. You pay attention to that. Let's look at some criminal justice news. There's certainly some interesting things going on since I spoke with you. I spoke with you last. Let's pick out a few of these stories here and see what they say. Well, Is there any end to what Homeland Security will be doing to protect us? Do you know what I'm talking about? We now have RoboCod, the latest weapon in Homeland Security's increasingly high-tech underwater arsenal. This is a robotic fish designed to safeguard the coastline of America and bring justice to the deep. Well, the new robot is named BioSwimmer, and it's actually not a cod, but a tuna. And they've studied the existence and development of the tuna, and it seems to be the most versatile fish on the planet, or in the ocean on the planet. And it's ultra-flexible in terms of its body and fins and moving parts and that type of thing. And we have actually spent your tax dollars in developing this little BioSwimmer is the name, and it's going to be put into the water, and it'll be protecting our coastline. So the next time you're down in Florida or one of the islands and you're out swimming, you see that cute little tuna swimming around underwater. If you got your head underwater and you're looking around, be careful. It could be a Homeland Security robotic device. But isn't that just great? Money so well spent. I just think it's super. This one is really funny. You have to love a country that wants to meet your needs. In Zurich, Switzerland, they're going to do something very good. I won't read the whole article. It's a long one. But the article talks about they're going to be building sex boxes, drive-in sex boxes in downtown. And it's going to be an attempt to rid the downtown of prostitution, actually on the streets. So I think they're going to build, council estimates, that 30 prostitutes meet clients at the site of the boxes. They use the drive-in slots. They go in and they have their sex. They pay up, of course, and then they drive out, and then there could be two or three cars in line going in to meet this particular person. But they're going to start out with like 30 of them. Isn't that nice? I mean, you won't even have to pay parking fees or anything like that. You just a drive-in sex box in order to help clean up downtown Zurich from streetwalking prostitutes. I love a nation that thinks. Deputy Police Commissioner in New York City, Paul Brown, nor other city officials could not remember the last time a day ended with three zeros. It likely didn't happen in 1990 when the city recorded 2,245 murders. I'm not kidding. And this year, New York's homicide is going to be about a little over 400 murders. Can you believe that? They have gone from 2,245 in 1990 until 400 this year. But here it was a few days ago where the city did not log a shooting, a cutting, stabbing, what was it said, or was it a rape also? But it did not happen. In other words, that was one day in one of the world's largest cities. And do you know how they managed to do that in New York City? When Mayor Giuliani was mayor and he brought in had a great police chief, and he started using crime analysis, they started to use stop and frisk tactics on the street. That means if you have reasonable suspicion that somebody is involved in a crime, is about to be involved in one, or could have been involved in one, then you're allowed and you have reasonable suspicion they're armed and dangerous, you can pat them down. You can't go directly into their clothes. Some people know about this stuff, some don't. But you can pat them down. And that decision came out of the Supreme Court way back in the 1960s. If you detect something that's a hard metallic object or it could be a weapon, then you're allowed to go in inside and do it. So what the New York City police did, they went out on the streets for days, months, and years, and they took the guns away from these gun criminals and then got them locked up for a long period of time. And surprise, the crime rate went down and the murder rate plummeted by the end of the decade. Down 2001, 2002, they had low crime rates. And again, we have the lowest crime rates in the United States than we've had in 50 years. But not true in Chicago. Keep in mind, Mayor Rahm Emanuel would like you to tweet him to tell him what to do about this. About the serious crime rate in that particular city. I saw where we got so many reports on Black Friday
last Friday, day after Thanksgiving, and shopping and all this kind of stuff. But the FBI had to run so many background checks based on the sale of firearms, their system broke down. Isn't that incredible? The record-checking system, it was a 20% increase over last year's Black Friday. So their whole system broke down. They had to refire the thing up because they were so busy, people buying firearms. And they said that President Obama is just one of the best salesperson on the block, in the nation for helping to sell guns. And remember what happened here a couple weeks ago. We weren't talking about it on the show, but some gun shop owner put a sign outside that said, Democrats are not welcome. And that helped his gun sales go up. That is actually something. Speaking of Black Friday, here's a news article that I think you should hear. According to emergency personnel, early estimates indicate that more than 42 million Americans were killed this past weekend in what is now believed to be the bloodiest Black Friday shopping event in history. First responders reporting from retail stores all across the nation said the record-breaking post-Thanksgiving shopping spree carnage began as early as midnight on Friday when 13 million shoppers were trampled, pummeled, burned, stabbed, shot, laced, and brutally beaten to death while attempting to participate in early holiday sales events. Law enforcement officials said the bloodbath only escalated throughout the weekend as hordes of savage holiday shoppers began murdering customers in Walmart, Sears, Penny's, and other locations. I'm going to stop, but this is a joke. And I talked to some people, students, and they don't even know. You must know about The Onion, right? The newspaper online, The Onion, super well-written, very professional, all kinds of sections. It looks like you're reading The New York Times or The Washington Post, but all the stories are false. But they're very well-written. So this is not true. We did not have a carnage on Black Friday, so I thought you might get a kick out of that. School tracking devices, remember, if you read the news here, they put that little girl out of school down in San Antonio because she didn't want to wear that microchip card. And a court has now ruled in that case where she doesn't have to do it. They're going to allow her back in that. She actually transferred to another school already, so maybe she doesn't want to come back. But they want to know where all the kids are every second while they're in the school. And they're saying, no, we don't want to, her family and her said, we don't want that. It shouldn't be. How long should a guy get in jail after he's convicted of his eighth consecutive DWI, in other words, drunk driving arrest? His last one, he had a blood alcohol level of 23.5 beers. Well, guess what he got in Texas? Como County, Texas, he got life in prison. Now, he can be out on parole in 10 years. He can be out on parole in how many years? He will be eligible for parole in 30 years when he's 75 years old. But this is his eighth consecutive DWI, and he got that type of sentence. He got life in prison. Now, as I've often said, probably, and you've heard me say on the show, never believe the sentence you read in the newspaper. More than likely, it will not happen. Now, if a guy gets executed, it was supposed to get execution, and it happened, then it happened. But there's so many ways to change and milk down a sentence that this guy, I'm thinking, in 8 years will be out, 10 years will be out, back on the street one more time. Let's hope he's not drinking when he does that. This is so disappointing. It almost brought tears to my eyes, this story. This will be our last one. The Central Intelligence Agency has disbanded its Center on Climate Change and National Security, a unit formed in 2009 to monitor the interplay between global warming, the warming planet, and intelligence and security challenges. I'm not kidding. The CIA had a center on climate change and national security. Thank you very much for paying your taxes. Now it's being downgraded. They're not doing away with the function. They're putting it into another unit. So let's hope it's cheaper in that particular unit. But can you believe that? I mean, we had a center within the Central Intelligence Agency that studies something like this. And aren't these some of the people that can't figure out we needed security at the consulate in Benghazi? Absolutely incredible. We'll have to wait and see on that story. I'm not going to comment on it until we know more about the. Hey, one more. I like this one. Illinois, I'll just give you the overview. They're now coming up with a way in the legislature to allow illegal immigrants to get driver's licenses, Illinois state driver's license. Isn't that nice? I love a country that welcomes you every way that they can. So now they can get their driver's license. They can get their all kinds of other services where they need a picture kind of ID. And if they don't want to show a picture ID, they can use those other ones that are phony that they bought somewhere else or brought in from Mexico. But that is just absolutely incredible. Well, enough of that. Let's go ahead and listen to Alex Smith's story about the homeless in four cities. And I think you'll enjoy this if you don't know much about homeless and how they live. He has another segment on his radio show also on archive.org about living in your car. It's about 15 minutes. It is very informative. I found out things about my battery I never knew, my car battery, and it explains some of the times I've had trouble with my battery. But anyway, we're going to go ahead and listen to that, and I hope you'll enjoy this. Let me find it here real quick.
This is Radio Eco Shock
with Alex Smith. Sorry about that. Some of the people camped out in Occupy Wall Street all over the country have nowhere else to go. As reported by Associated Press, Occupy encampments from Portland, Oregon, through L.A. to Atlanta are finding homeless people moving into tent cities set up by protesters. Some Occupy sites are finding bylaws written to send away the homeless are being used to prevent constitutional rights of freedom of assembly and expression. Polls show millions of Americans are just one paycheck away from losing their homes. Many more are already in foreclosure, being evicted, or already out on the street. Lots of us worry, could I be next? Could you handle it the way things are now? Maybe the rights of the homeless will matter to you down the line. Radio EcoShock is going to take you on a quick tour of homelessness in North America. We'll visit New York City, where 36,000 school children have no home. San Francisco, where it is illegal to sit or lie on a sidewalk. Even in the capital, in Washington, D.C., we'll find the homeless next to the limousines and lobbyists. In Canada, there is a little progress in Vancouver, with street sleepers reduced by 80%, but are they just being hidden away?
I got an idea about homelessness. What they ought to do? Change the name of it. Change the name of it. It's not homelessness. It's houselessness. It's houses these people need. A home is an abstract idea. A home is a setting. It's a state of mind. These people need houses. Physical, tangible structures. They need low-cost housing. But where are you going to put it? Well, fine. Where are you going to put it? Where are you going to put it? Nobody wants you to build low-cost housing near their house. People don't want it near them. We got something in this country you've heard of. It's called NIMBY, N-I-M-B-Y. Not in my backyard. People don't want anything, any kind of social help located anywhere near them. You try to open up a halfway house. Try to open up a drug rehab or an alcohol rehab center. Try to do a homeless shelter somewhere. Try to open up a little home for some retarded people who want to work their way into the community. People say, not in my backyard. People don't want anything near them, especially if it might help somebody else.
There are somewhere between 600,000 and a million homeless people in America. The wild thing is, America is flooded with empty houses. 1 in 10 homes in the United States is vacant. That's about 18 million homes. If we guesstimate, there are as many as 500,000 families needing a home. There are 18 empty homes for every one of them. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, all housing was owned by the government. As Dmitry Orlov has told us on Radio EcoShock, people just stayed where they were, so there was no wave of homelessness in Russia or its member states during those harsh economic times. But America is stuck. Houses sit empty. Sometimes the banks even tear them down. But people, many of them families with young children, keep getting foreclosed, evicted, kicked out onto the street, and nobody wants them. Apparently, capitalism just can't handle degrowth. As winter approaches and the economy heads into the dumpster, homelessness is growing in New York City. The nasty surprise is that both the state and city appear to be slashing help for the homeless in their hour of greatest need. Radio EcoShock visits the Big Apple with Giselle Routier, policy analyst for the NYC Coalition for the Homeless. We'll talk with Jennifer Freidenbach, executive director of the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness. Why has this formerly welcoming city gone into a media orgy of bashing the poor? We'll go to Washington, D.C. to speak with Michael Farrell, executive director of the district's Coalition for the Homeless, to see what is going on there. Our last stop is Vancouver, Canada, with famous anti-poverty activist Gene Swanson of the Carnegie Community Action Project and author of the book Poor Bashing, The Politics of Exclusion. This ain't no social cause. Homelessness in a land of wealth is a national disgrace. In San Francisco, we learn the city has stopped counting the number of homeless people found dead on the streets every year. The average is at least 100 deaths in just one city. An estimated 37,000 homeless Americans die every year. That is more than in any foreign war. About 155 of them are murdered, as some as hate crimes for the fun of it or out of a desire to kill someone vulnerable. You won't see this on TV, but there is a National Homeless Persons Memorial Day on December 21st, 2011, to remember those victims of a system that just didn't care. World Homeless Day this year was on October 10th. Remember that? All the news specials and the coverage? I didn't think so. Let's take a tour of the tragedy of homelessness in North America. Radio EcoShock visits the Big Apple with Giselle Routier, policy analyst for the NYC Coalition for the Homeless. Hello, Giselle.
Hello.
Last spring, your organization released a State of the Homeless 2011 report. What did you find?
Well, what we found is that over the past year, in 2010, homelessness in New York City reached record levels. Throughout the year in 2010, over 113,500 men, women, and children slept in New York City shelters, and that includes 42,000 children. And that was the highest level recorded within a year-long period. And then what we also saw was that the average nightly census numbers among homeless folks in shelter also reached record highs in the past year as well. So in February, we saw that there were over 39,000 men, women, and children in shelters on a single night. So that's what we've been seeing over the past year. That's what we documented in our report. It has a lot to do with both the economy, but a little bit more to do with the policies of this mayoral administration and what's being done to assist the homeless.
Well, let's be clear. Absolute records are being set in total homeless people in New York, the number of homeless families and kids and more. But I did a Google search for recent news about the plight of the citizens of New York in the last month, and it showed practically nothing. Are the homeless being hidden?
I think it's more of a hidden problem, I would say, specific to New York as well. In New York City, we actually have a right to shelter. That exists in nowhere else in the country. So the majority of folks that are homeless in New York City are going to be in a shelter, which makes the problem much more hidden, even though it is still a huge problem. So you do see fewer people on the streets here in New York, although you see that as well. But because we have a right to shelter, the vast majority of people that are homeless are in shelters.
Well, Giselle, tell us more about the response to these record numbers. Let's start with the state of New York.
Well, I would say more of a city kind of problem that we're seeing. Specifically starting, you know, in 2005, we've seen these numbers go up. So before the economy even tanked, we started seeing the numbers of homeless families, homeless men and women going up. And that's directly related to some of the policy changes that they made on a city level. So in 2005, Mayor Bloomberg decided to cut off homeless families and individuals from gaining access to federal housing resources. So what I mean by federal housing resources are Section 8 vouchers, public housing, so the type of permanent housing that's funded by the federal government. So prior to that, homeless families would get a priority on the top of the long waiting list for those resources and be able to access a certain portion of Section 8 vouchers and public housing. In 2005, the mayor stopped that, and since then, virtually no homeless families have gotten access to those resources. And what he did instead was institute these time-limited city-funded subsidies. So it's gone through several different iterations, but the latest one was called Advantage. It was time-limited to 2 years. And what we've seen since that program was put into effect was that, yes, it would help families move out, but there are more and more families coming back into the shelter system after their 2 years runs out. So what we've seen since 2005 is a huge increase in the number of families that are experiencing a repeat episode of homelessness, so coming back into the system after exiting for a brief period of time. And so that has fed significantly to the numbers that naturally went up when the economy tanked. So that's sort of compounded that problem, and now we have record numbers. And at the beginning of this year, the mayor ended the time-limited subsidies as well. So we have now, for the first time ever, no program in place to help families move out of shelter, whether permanent housing or temporary. And it's causing massive problems, and we're still not quite seeing, you know, what the effect of that might be, because it was just earlier this year that big families got cut off from all subsidies. So I think what we're going to be seeing in the coming months, especially fall and winter, when we sometimes see a rise in homelessness, that it's just going to be astronomical.
Giselle, let's talk about homeless kids in New York City classrooms. The New York City Department of Homeless Services reported 8,000 school-aged children have no home, but the federal government said it was more like 40,000 kids. What's going on there?
That's right. There is a broader, the federal government uses a broader definition of homelessness. So what the city is measuring is specifically children that are in homeless shelters. The federal government uses a broader definition, so that would include people who are in homeless shelters or families that are living in doubled-up situations or with other family members or don't have a nightly place to go that's the same, that's consistent. So it's a broader definition that the federal government uses, so it does capture more students that are living in situations that are not permanent or unstable.
So if these kids are going back to shelters, there is a right to shelter, are they getting a chance to shower? Do they have a place to do their homework? Is it going to work for them?
I mean, there's a place to shower, but it does disrupt children's lives. I mean, the research has consistently shown over the past several decades that homeless kids face a lot of barriers in schooling and will most of the time be underachieving in school compared to other poor children that are housed. And that's because of, you know, a lot of different things. There's instability in their lives. It's difficult to find a place, like you said, to do their homework that's quiet, that's not around a lot of other people. They've been uprooted. They're facing a lot of times emotional distress or behavioral problems, and a lot of these things compound into directly causing an underachievement in school or seeing a decline in their achievement in school. So that is definitely an issue. I mean, we've also seen in studies that as soon as a family is rehoused and permanent, then a student can rebound very well. But while they're homeless, that added stress from what they're experiencing is very real.
Rocker Cyndi Lauper has recently thrown the spotlight on the number of lesbian, gay, and transgender youth on the streets of New York. Some of them were kicked out by their parents and now live in a risky environment. Are you seeing this problem?
That's definitely a problem in New York City, and it's a very specific population, and it's tough, too, because New York City does have a right to shelter, but this is a population that by nature is sometimes tough to serve or will feel unsafe in a larger city shelter with men and women of all different ages and different sexual orientations. And so a lot of times kids that are running away from home and facing a myriad of other problems will prefer to stay on the streets than going into the shelter. And so there are some specialized shelter and services for those kids, but not enough to meet the need. So that is a big issue in terms of getting specific services to really address needs of younger homeless kids and homeless LGBT kids. And we don't see enough of that.
This is Radio Eagle Shock. I'm Alex Smith with Giselle Ruggie, policy analyst with the New York City Coalition for the Homeless. Giselle, I'd like to run through a rapid-fire checklist on the rights of the homeless in New York. Please try to give me fast answers if you can, even yes or no if that works. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Is it legal in New York for a homeless person to sit on the sidewalk?
Yes, as long as they're not blocking traffic.
How about a homeless family? Can they sleep in a public place?
Again, it sort of depends. The park, public parks have curfews, so that would generally be a no, but we've seen families, we've encountered families who slept in laundromats or in restaurants or other places, so people tend to get interesting when they need to find a place to sleep outside.
Is there anywhere in greater New York area where homeless people can legally pitch a tent to live in?
I'm actually unaware of that. I really don't know what that would be. Like I said, you know, if it was in the New York City five boroughs, you know, the only place I could think of that they would do that would be in a park, but in public parks there are curfews or the park's closed at midnight, so I don't see how that would really happen. As far as outside of New York City, I can't say.
Okay. Is it legal to sleep in a car or camper in New York?
Yeah.
Does New York have public washrooms accessible to the homeless?
Again, folks that are living on the streets will get creative in terms of finding what they need, but there are public restrooms throughout the city.
Good. Do we know how many homeless New Yorkers are found dead on the streets each winter?
I do not have that information. No, I do not know.
Okay. Can a homeless person vote in state elections?
Yes, of course.
Can a homeless vote in city elections?
Yes, of course.
And my final one, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate the New York City police if 10 is where the officers protect the homeless and 1 is where the homeless are generally harassed or beat by the police? Your rating of the police?
I would say it's on the lower end. You know, for the most part, the police will try to move homeless folks along. But in a lot of circumstances, they'll leave them alone if they're not causing any trouble. So it's, you know, maybe a 5, 50, 50.
Okay, let's go for longer talk here. First, the New York Times reports 1 in 5 New Yorkers are living below the poverty line. Other news reports show the general welfare rate in New York City has fallen by 4%, but welfare numbers are skyrocketing in surrounding areas like Long Island. Giselle, has there been an assessment of how many people are homeless because we don't treat their mental health or medical problems? Do we have any idea how that stands?
The data on that is pretty hard to measure. I mean, one thing we do know is that the rates of mental illness among homeless single adults are higher than among the general population. And we also know that among those that sleep on the streets, the rates of mental illness are higher than those that are in the shelter system. But it's hard to say. I don't think there's been any way to accurately measure what leads or in how many instances the reason they're homeless is because of their mental illness or other disability.
And the New York Coalition for the Homeless is one of the oldest such institutions in the country. Giselle Ruthier, what are your organization priorities for the coming winter of discomfort for those 100,000 and more New Yorkers who will need services this winter?
Our biggest priority this winter is really advocating that the city put in place some type of program to give a solution to folks that are in shelters. So our biggest priority is to get the city to reinstate priority for federal housing resources for homeless families and individuals. So that's the biggest thing. I mean, it won't cost the city anything, and it will provide immediate housing resources to homeless families and individuals who at the moment have none. So that's been our biggest focus. I mean, aside from that, we do also, you know, keep track of the amount of shelter capacity that the city has and make sure they have enough to meet the need. But what we'd rather see is actually folks moving out into permanent housing, and that's something that there is a complete lack of a plan right now. So that's what we're going to be focusing on.
Giselle, can you give us your website address and maybe tell us how we can help?
Absolutely. Our website is www.coalitionforthehomeless.org. And there's a lot of information on our website about what's happening in New York City with the homeless population. There's statistics. There's a take action page to write to the mayor and write to the city and about what they can do to improve the situation. So I would encourage anybody to really check that out.
Obviously, we've just touched the surface in a deep problem in the financial capital of the world. Our guest is Giselle Ruthier from the New York Coalition for the Homeless. Thank you, Giselle.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
To the homeless in the city, city center. the way.
We're going to be all right.
Oh, Glenn, we made it.
We continue our survey of homelessness in major cities. Jennifer Friedenbach is the executive director of the San Francisco Coalition for Homelessness. Jennifer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think there is a connection between the Occupy San Francisco movement and the plight of the homeless?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, a lot of the folks that are involved in Occupy San Francisco are without housing themselves. And I think that a lot of folks are protesting what has happened in the financial industry and what the financial industry has done to the economy of the United States. And so folks have lost their housing, folks are out of work, folks are really struggling, and they don't see the response they'd like to see. And a lot of things go back to the financial industry's fault.
Right. The homeowners didn't get bailed out. They just got the dirty end of the stick.
Right, exactly. And in fact, interestingly enough, the same sector also funded laws in San Francisco that made it illegal to sit and lie on San Francisco sidewalks. They funded those campaigns. The last campaign, about 70% of the funding came from the financial sector. We also have the financial sector in places like Wells Fargo funding the creation of private prisons in the United States. We also have a lot of price gouging going on for people who are just regular customers of banks that's hurting people economically. There's just a lot of stuff going on. We have the cities are in a situation where they're making cuts to social programs that impacts homeless people and other low-income people. And oftentimes the localities are making cuts because their pension funds are losing money. Or alternatively, usually both, they got really bad loans from the financial industry for bonds that were issued. And so there's a lot of push to try to renegotiate those bonds so that then the city can save money and stave off cuts to social services. So it's all very much connected.
It's one big circle. And could you explain for us this sit, lie, buy law? How did it come about, and what does it really mean for people who have no home?
Well, you know, really, from our perspective, it was put on the ballot. There's in San Francisco, like a lot of big American cities, homelessness is used as political football for folks who are running for office. And it's also used locally as a wedge issue on the ballot to try to drive more conservative voters to the poll and impact elections. And we believe that's why Sit Lie was put on the ballot, was one of our districts that could have gone either way, liberal or conservative, and was up for re-election. And we've always believed that that's why it was put on the ballot. It basically means 30 days in jail on the second offense for anyone sitting or lying on sidewalks in San Francisco. And it doesn't require a witness, and it does not require, of course, a crime to be committed. So from a civil rights perspective, it's a very problematic law. Interestingly enough, there's been talk of using it against the protesters, and the chief of police decided actually that they were not going to use it against the protesters, that they're going to selectively enforce the law. So in other words, they're using it against people who they deem to be sitting or lying on the sidewalk because they're too poor to afford a place to live and they would be in violation versus people who are there because they're in protest. So it's pretty problematic from a civil rights perspective.
Is that 24/7, or are there certain hours where you can't just sit down?
It's time specific. And so there's other laws. There's actually 33 laws that are on the books that target poor people. And some of them are state laws and some of them are local laws. But yeah, that was our Sit Lie law was number 33.
Are there more homeless people in the Bay Area as the economy fails to recover?
There is, absolutely. We have in San Francisco, we have the highest wait list for shelters for families that we've ever had. It reached a high point last week, in fact. And we have, you know, about half as many more single adults than before looking for housing. The interesting thing is about, in both the families and the folks who don't have kids, about 60% of them are homeless for the first time. So we have people who, you know, that are newly homeless that have never experienced this before. They're mostly all poor people. You know, I mean, this kind of idea that for folks who have access to accumulated wealth, they're likely not going to become homeless. And more likely, it's going to be low-income, working-class people who don't have access to accumulated wealth, who don't have families that, you know, have large houses that they can move into when times get tough.
Well, if this happens all of a sudden to somebody, and it can, you just suddenly come home and you're evicted, what is a person to do? What are the first steps that a person could take?
Well, I think the most important thing for folks is to try to stay in their housing, of course. It's much more difficult once you lose your housing. So to do that, there's oftentimes local programs that'll give rental assistance. And part of the Obama stimulus package, the first one around, was this program that does homeless prevention over a longer period of time. So let's say you're out of work for 9 months, they'll help you pay your rent during that time. There's programs that people should check with their municipal government, try to stay in housing. I think the other thing to do is to really reach out and be resourceful, you know, reach out to everyone you know and find out if folks can help you out. And I think that our culture has kind of isolated us from one another, and this idea that we all kind of stand independently, but, you know, folks are willing to help and are happy to do it oftentimes. And so that's what folks should keep in mind as well. There may be local shelters, et cetera, that folks can access, but I think the more immediate thing is to stay in your housing. And I mean, if you can't stay in your housing, to be resourceful with your own network and reach out to families and friends about folks who can put you up.
And I guess if that doesn't work, your other resource is other homeless people who will tell you where you can get a meal and where you can get by.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in different localities, they have different resource lists and different systems on how to access shelter, et cetera. But, you know, a lot of that information can be available electronically on the web in most municipalities.
And you mentioned that families are having to wait to get into a shelter. How long are they having to wait? And it's hard for me to picture this. What does a single mother with three kids do while waiting for a shelter? Where are they living?
In San Francisco right now, it's about a 6 to 9 month wait. So what families are doing is, you know, they're moving from place to place. You know, they'll move in for a few nights with some friends, maybe a few nights in a hotel, maybe a few nights with family, and just keep trying to put different things together, sometimes sleeping in their cars. So, yeah, folks really, it's really destabilizing. Unfortunately, a lot of times the families end up splitting up. So maybe the kids go stay with someone and then the parents have to stay somewhere else. That's a pretty typical situation. Sometimes for single women, they have to make choices around, you know, staying in places that are not always very safe if they're a single mom. And that's a very uncomfortable, terrible decision that folks are faced with. So it's really traumatizing. It's a very, very difficult situation. And of course, because, you know, human beings are, you know, we're not meant to live outdoors. We're meant to, you know, we really have this natural tendency towards home. And it's really incredibly traumatizing for people.
How many homeless school children are there in Frisco, and how are they coping?
We have close to 2,000, and so that would be school-aged, registered in our public schools. I know that there's been some national numbers that the numbers are pretty staggering nationwide, and they really are going up and up because the school districts keep track of, you know, how many kids they have without housing in their district. So it's really, really a tough situation. And it's, you know, when we have families that are in this situation and they get housing, they talk so much about the difference it has made for their kids in terms of their ability to succeed at school and what the family relationships are like. And every part of the life just is totally transformed when they have safe and dignified housing to live in. So it really does impact kids in a lot of ways. You know, for really little kids, maybe, you know, there's a lot of kids don't reach their developmental milestones if they don't have a place to live. So, you know, you think about kids crawling at a certain age, you know, about 7 months to 9 months and starting to walk at 1 year. And if you don't have a home and you're constantly in a stroller all day, every day, and you're moving around, those developmental milestones just don't get hit. And education, the same kind of impact. So kids really struggle with it. It's really very destabilizing for them.
Jennifer Friedenbach, local newspapers have run horror stories about panhandling in the city. What is your take?
You know, this is another one of those election things. We've been doing a ton of outreach. We've been talking to everybody that's involved in the panhandling, you know, panhandlers and street performers and all kinds of folks, and nobody has noted an increase in panhandling. So we kind of think of it as an election ploy. We see it. We have a mayoral election coming on right now. Typically, we would see an increase in panhandling with an economic downturn. We haven't found any evidence of that, you know, but that's the sign of poverty in any country, in any culture, place in the world. You're going to basically be able to see what level of poverty exists in a society by the numbers of panhandlers. It's a very common indicator. And so, you know, in San Francisco, we have a pretty high level of poverty. We have half of our school children in San Francisco are having free or reduced lunch, which means that they're living below the poverty line. Living below in the poverty line in San Francisco, which is a very expensive city to live in, both food and rent and other cost of living indicators, is a real struggle. So, you know, we have a very affluent city, but really we have two cities. We have extremely poor people and extremely affluent people.
Yeah, that's sort of what Occupy Wall Street is about, I think, for sure. How is San Francisco doing when it comes to providing supportive housing as a long-term solution for homeless people?
I think San Francisco's been pretty good in terms of really trying to ensure that a large amount of the general fund goes towards creating supportive housing. And that ends up, from a fiscal perspective, a very smart thing to do, because you save so much money in emergency costs and criminal justice costs and all these other kind of societal costs. So it's actually a lot less expensive for folks to be in housing than to be out on the streets for a municipality. So emergency room visits alone, because of what happens to somebody if they're living outside, colds turning into pneumonia, infections turning into loss of limbs. I mean, all these things, it really is very costly. So we're pretty smart about it. We're nowhere near meeting the need. The homeless crisis, of course, was caused by the federal government's massive cuts, especially previous to 1983, and we reached our lowest point in 1983, and our first shelters opened up around the country. And since then, our homeless population has only grown, because we really haven't invested in the housing that we had after the New Deal. And so that steady deterioration of housing, of affordable housing, has led to, and that and the growing disparity between wages and rents, has grown to this crisis that we're facing. So until the federal government really gets serious about solving the problems and making a commitment to the very basic human right of housing, localities are going to continue to struggle with this issue.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Jennifer Friedenbach, Executive Director of the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness. Jennifer, I think we're doing pretty well here. Do you have some more time? We could keep going?
Sure.
Okay. Well, in New York City, we found up to 40% of the young homeless aged 18 to 24 were partly there due to gender issues, being lesbian, gay, or transgender. Should we presume that's a problem in San Francisco, and what is being done to address their needs?
In San Francisco, we definitely are a mecca in terms of folks coming here who are persecuted because of their LGBT status in other areas. And when they come, you know, they're often find that there's no resources here to help them, or very little. And so we absolutely have that issue here in San Francisco of young people who, you know, they don't have the family or, you know, the support system in place to help them. You know, and young people really need that, especially nowadays. It's very difficult to live independently because of that rent income disparity and the amount of income that young people are going to be able to earn. It's very difficult to afford rent. So absolutely, that's an issue here.
Jennifer, I'd like to ask you a few quick questions as we compare the rights of the homeless in San Francisco to other cities. Please try to give me a few fast answers if you can, even yes or no, if that works. Are you ready?
Sure.
Is it legal for a homeless family to sleep in a public place in San Francisco?
Yes. It's illegal.
It's illegal?
Yeah.
Okay, can't do it. Is there anywhere in San Francisco area where homeless people can legally pitch a tent to live in?
No, there's nowhere legally they can pitch a tent to live in.
Okay. Is it legal to sleep in a car or camper in San Francisco?
It is illegal.
Cannot do that either. So if I'm found sleeping in a car, the police officer will ask me to do something else.
Exactly.
Okay. Does San Francisco have public washrooms accessible to the homeless?
It has some, but very limited.
Do we know how many homeless people in San Francisco are found dead on the streets each winter?
We stopped doing the count several years ago. The City Department of Public Health decided to stop doing it for political reasons, but usually by word of mouth, we find at least 100.
Can a homeless person vote in state elections?
Yes.
Can the homeless vote in city elections?
Yes.
And final question, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate the San Francisco police if 10 is where officers protect the homeless, and one is the homeless are generally harassed or even beaten by the police? Your rating of San Francisco police?
Probably around a 3 or 4.
Well, Jennifer, let's get back to more extended issues. I began by pointing out in these uncertain times anybody could lose their job. You've mentioned that it's mostly poor people. Are you seeing some middle-class people who are surprised that they just don't have any options now?
We see some. That is not going to be as typical. I mean, I think folks who, for example, folks who are middle class but maybe had steady income but didn't come from a legacy of accumulated wealth, maybe they were the first one in their families to get a college degree or, you know, this kind of thing, and they really don't have a lot to fall back on. You know, middle class is kind of a mushy word, and so we're never really sure what that means. But certainly most people who are homeless are, you know, are working, what we would consider working class, folks who definitely spent most of their life working, but probably at lower wage jobs that don't have a lot of stability.
Well, Jennifer, just give me a minute to talk about a problem which relates to corporate greed and the Ponzi housing crash. This homeless crisis in the U.S. all sounds a little crazy to an outsider. California has a record number of empty houses. Most of them are ultimately owned, or at least the mortgage is guaranteed by the federal government agency like Fannie Mae. And we have crowds of people with kids out on the street, while thousands of homes sit empty. Do you think America will figure out a solution to that?
I think we can. I think we absolutely can. And I think that with political will and with the commitment at the federal level, we could solve this housing crisis relatively quickly. And we could have even done it with 30 days of Iraq war spending, for example. We could have housed every man, woman, and child through the rest of their lifetimes just with the amount of money we spent in 30 days. So it really is a matter of political will. And I think for the United States, it's an incredibly important issue that we make sure all of our people are housed.
Well, that leads to the question, why do we tolerate homelessness?
You know, our political system really, you know, has favored greed. And we have a situation where, you know, in the United States, greed rules in so many different ways. And we really need to change that around, where we come from a place of human rights. We come from a place of dignity and mutual respect for all human beings.
Well, back on working with the homeless, what are your priorities for the coming winter for the people in San Francisco?
Well, for us, we're working on identifying empty buildings. We're going to try to, you know, hopefully get them turned over to families and other homeless people. Certainly our priorities is getting, we're